You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
My name is Rick Kleffel, and this show is a narrative species. Liza Monroe worked in the mailroom of the William Morris Agency until she decided to pursue a career as a writer. She's worked on Modern Love Calm for the New York Times. Her work there was the basis of her collection of essays, Seen as Your Shoes Are Soon to Be on Fire. She's the author of The Mayor Jack, The Risk I Took to Keep My Best Friend in America, and What It Taught Us About Love, and the book Mexican High. She'll be appearing at Bookshop Santa Cruz on Wednesday, January 15th from 7 to 8 p.m. for her new novel, The Distractions. Thank you for joining me, Liza.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here today.
This book is really beautifully written. And I just want to know about the world building. Did you just come up with it's written kind of in a parallel language. It's very easy to understand. It's reminiscent of A Clockwork Orange. In that way, it's easier to understand what's going on than in that book. But did the language create the world, or did the world create the language?
That's a great question. Thank you so much for kicking us off with that. I am typically a writer of autofiction and memoir and creative nonfiction, personal essay. So pretty much everything I'd written until The Distractions was concretely grounded in reality, in personal experience, in research that was very concretely tangible. And so I was really surprised when I was writing The Distractions that it sort of started telling me, it started out being set in our current world, in the present day, and it kind of started leaking in a way into this speculative universe, almost like I had no control over it. And I thought, oh no, you know, I don't know how to world build. You know, I've read some Philip K. Dick and I've read Clockwork Orange. I love these novels. I enjoy sci-fi, but it's not my go-to. Speculative fiction wasn't in my wheelhouse at all. And so I panicked a little and thought, oh no, why is it doing this to me? And then slowly, with regards to language that you asked about, it was almost as if the world building happened from the direction the world was going anyway, and I would just exaggerate it. So in the novel, nobody uses the word life. The word life has been forgotten, and people say content. So they would say, right, this was the best, most fulfilling moment of my entire content so far. And that's just kind of, it's playing with and poking fun of a little bit of the internet speak and the social media language that we use, that to me sort of seems, you know, part of the everyday and the lexicon, but also a bit dystopian and bizarre if you take it and exaggerate it. And then one more thing for world building was that I would look at just our contemporary problems, right? Say something like factory farming leading to climate change and lab grown meat as sort of a futuristic solution to that. And so in this world, it's all lab grown meat by then. And there's no more factory farming because humanity has gone to the brink with climate change. There's no more traffic, right? I'm sitting on the one a lot, bumper to bumper waiting. It's like, oh, what if we all had self-driving cars and this was perfectly timed and we knew there would never be traffic, right? So the world of The Distractions is all self-driving cars. So kind of taking those little glimmers of future and just running with them, exaggerating them and making them present.
It also is the a perfect realization of a feature as suggested by a modern Italian philosopher and memorialized in a wonderful Ramones style t-shirt, fully automated luxury communism, in which everybody has everything they need by virtue of well-managed automation. Talk about creating this world. And one of the things I think you do really well in this world, I love Philip K. Dick too, but when I was reading Philip K. Dick, it was probably back in the 80s. And, you know, he has all these really far-flung futures set in what for him was the far-flung future. He written right in 1967. So he'd set his novels in 1999. And it just seemed weird. It's just a bit dislocating. Your novel, you don't give up a date, but you do at one point suggest what the difference is when you refer to somebody's great, 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 great grandmother's recipe. And I think, okay, I thought that was a very clever way to suggest pretty far in the future, but no definite date.
I wanted the reader to be able to play with that idea, and I was hoping that could be kind of a book club discussion question or a reader's guide question, right? When exactly does this take place? Because in a way, it's very much almost of our times now with the regards to automation and artificial intelligence and having sort of, you know, virtual avatars we can chat with, who take care of us, that kind of thing. But it's also very much an alternate reality and a future world where words in our lexicon, like marriage or partner or gendered terms, anything, things that are familiar to us are gone, in a way flattened out and made very even keeled. There's no real sort of way to tell, like, how long would it take for this language to actually change? But I do give hints like that, the great, 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 great grandmother's chicken recipe, right? And now the chicken is like a contraband item. There's no more factory farming, and people have everything made for them. But I leave it to the reader to play with those ideas and guess about what the timeline might be. In my imagination, it's anywhere from as close as 50 years to as far as a couple hundred years. But I think, and during the time that I was writing the book from 10 years ago till now, things have caught up with the book in a way. As I was writing it, things started happening, right? AI, intensification of climate change, even things like in the book, the characters put on sort of a weatherproof, heatproof suit to be able to go outside in the climate in Las Vegas. And I'd seen on my Instagram targeted ads, almost like it was reading me writing the novel, a little ad for a suit that has a head bubble and everything that was called a fire season suit to be able to go outside during fires, like what we experienced in Santa Cruz in 2020, and breathe the air, and it would kind of take care of that for you. Even down to little details like that, virtual personal trainers, bots that do things for you, and our customer service, lots of things that are happening now. While I was writing the book, the actual technology was catching up with the book. So while it could be set several hundred years in the future, a lot of things in it will be recognizable from our times right now, which wasn't on purpose. It was a coincidence, but it sort of brings timelines together in that way, that there's things we'll recognize from our contemporary reality, but then there are things that are like, oh, that seems so foreign and futuristic, but I can kind of understand how it could have gotten that way if we can't stay on the path that we're on right now.
You know, as a kid, I grew up in the 70s and early 70s and late 60s. And I was always fascinated with the future. I was, you know, very interested in the space flight, the whole space program. I was the kid who cut out all the pictures of In Life and Look magazine, no longer with us, that, you know, showed the special effects from 2001. And I was thinking, I'm going to get to live to be through 2001. And never in my life, I imagine, I would spend the eve of, you know, the year 2000 sitting up all night staring at a terminal connected to our VAX, which was 25 years old and had to be updated to handle the dates in Y2K, and it was a complete disaster. But I think I thought you did a great job of giving a really good example of, you know, what William Gibson describes things as the future has arrived, but it's just not distributed evenly. You know, we always think the future replaces the past, but it's just laid on top of it as best as can be. And it's like, you know, somebody didn't do a good job frosting that cake with the future.
I totally agree with that. And I didn't want it to be pinpointable, right? To say like, oh, this is 2097 and then 2097 comes and it just seems like a totally wacky, outdated vision from some author earlier in the century that no longer makes sense. Or I didn't want to pin it to a date. I wanted it to be kind of more of a thought piece and let readers guess at that. And then if somewhere down the line someone finds it in a dusty old secondhand bookstore, they won't necessarily know it's about their time. It could always kind of be any layered vision of the future.
You know, one of the things that makes this book so wonderful is, you know, your feminine point of view. You do a really great job of showing what it would be like for a woman to live in the future with her particular concerns, which is something that I had never even, like, my little tiny brain had never even considered as an aspect of living in the future. But your character does a great job of bringing that to the forefront, but not wearing her sausage on her sleeves, so to speak.
Yeah, in that sense, it's a very feminine love story in a way. And I always think of this book as fundamentally kind of being about the ways that technology and social media especially amplify and extend the human tendency to obsess over things. And Misha, the protagonist, becomes very obsessed with a certain guy who happens to have his job being a social media celebrity in the future, what we would now call an influencer. But in this world of the distractions, they're basically celebrities who have sponsored content. So basically they're living their absolute most glamorous, best, incredible lives, all on different companies' dimes, just to use the products, drink the beverages, show the fashion, travel to the space colony and show the tourism there, like all kinds of sponsored content. And so she believes that she knows this person after a brief time of meeting them, a brief connection. And she's like kind of becomes a hopeless romantic in her midlife after sort of rejecting traditional, what we would think of as love and romance and relationships, rejecting that throughout her youth, preferring to focus on her career and just herself and to create this perfect little, almost isolated existence. So in that way, she was almost like a non-traditionally sort of feminine characteristics were built into her, in that she avoided love and intimacy. But then it's about really how all of that gets exploded because she can keep watching this person on the future version of the internet and continue to see and feel like she knows him, how the technology sort of creates this false sense of intimacy. And I wanted to tell that from a point of view that was both familiar and very different from my own. So I definitely tapped into some of my own ideas and experiences to build the way that she has this sort of romantic obsession that I think we traditionally associate more maybe with romance novels.
There is a bit of a feel of a romance novel in this, but it's very, I think, smoothed out, and it's fascinating. I love the sense of narrative in this, the way you tell the kind of overlapping stories. Talk about your sense of what a long story like this, a novel, should be, and how this novel came into being, the different story parts that overlap with the different voices.
Yeah, I had never undertaken anything like this before because, as I said earlier, I wrote a memoir, I wrote personal essay, and everything I wrote was in the first person, from the limited first person point of view, and that's how I wrote. It came very naturally to me. And I think I'd just gotten to a different point in my own life and as a writer too, where I felt I'd kind of done everything that I could imagine doing, and I wanted to do something completely different and challenge myself and stay engaged. I was just getting really feeling torn away from first person, straight up, like realistic you know, here's something from life and here's what it might mean and how it might be universal. I've been doing that move over and over in essays and in my first novel. So I just wanted to break that entirely. And I didn't know how. I think I sort of learned how, or the novel, this writing this novel taught me how. It taught me. And I had become a mother in the time of writing my last book in this one. And I think to your earlier point too about the female point of view, I was just feeling very fractured and fragmented myself as far as, you know, attention I could give my work and my writing versus raising these little people who had come for me but were pretty new in my life and thrown into that, not knowing what to expect, going back to work, right? I felt almost like in various parts. And that ended up translating in the novel, I think. A secondary protagonist named Ari is a gallery curator who has a special needs child and is also in her maternity leave time became an influencer, like a momfluencer, showing her perfect child doing all these amazing things, eating in fine restaurants, right? I kind of played with that and had fun with it. But then when the child turns out to have a kind of condition, she's trying to hide that. So her sections are in third person, because I was kind of seeing her as, whereas Misha's sections are first person, I was seeing Ari as like she's over there, she's this other person who Misha's watching. And then there was a third layer that presented itself to me that really unlocked what the distractions is in its current form as the book. It was the final piece because I went through this book kind of like just grasping in the dark, right? Like, what is this? It's not like anything I've written before. It's not based on my experience. It can't be. It's so, right, something totally other. So the final piece that presented itself to me is a mystery narrator layer on top of the entire story of Misha's obsessions and distractions, which is that Misha herself is an AI developer, and she had made an algorithm that was canceled and entirely disposed of because it had become capable of love. And as it had become capable of love, it started to become capable of the darker sides of that. So obsession, desire, control, all these things that were the flip side of love that could went along with it. So it too started to seep into the story, and then it all clicked because I realized, right, maybe this thing had gotten out. Maybe it had gone rogue. And actually, it's one of my favorite characters. There are lots of characters in this novel, and it's one of my favorite characters because I find it to be very human, oddly, even though it's an AI. I find it to be very human and that it just has the best of intentions. It just wants the best for Misha, and it really wants to do right by her, and it really cares about her. But its perceptions are just quite off. So what it thinks she needs might not actually be good for her. So I find it to be very human, right? We always have the best intentions and we're doing the best we can, right? But it might not be right what a partner needs or what a parent needs or what a child needs. And so I find that kind of flawed nature of relationship really fun to play with the AI character.
Well, I guess what we're looking at is a future where the old saw becomes the most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm an AI and I'm here to help you. I mean, we're pretty close to that already. One of the things that I thought was really beautifully done in this book was, the perception, the slow altering of perceptions of life from being, about life to being about content. And I think this is a really interesting shift because it's from a shift from experience to exhibition. So talk about, discovering that, was that discovered in the story or was that? How much of this, I guess, I'm asking too, is how much of this did you know going in, and how much of it grew in the petri dish of your novel?
That's a great observation and question. I have been feeling over the years that social media was a little bit too much like posturing of beautiful moments of putting up my own, right? I only put up fun, great things. I don't put up the sad, tragic parts of life. And I know there has been more of a movement through the years to put real things on social media, people crying, right? People cooking their breakfast, whatever kinds of things. But I've just been feeling so much, right? So many of the moments that I was going through some years back were like, great, let's get that picture for to put it on Facebook. Or like, it takes you out of the moment because you're thinking about how it's going to be in the post or like what the picture is going to look like or how will I capture this moment. And actually, as a writer of creative nonfiction, personal essay, and memoir, that was kind of how I operated anyway. And I think part of the sort of anti-social media slant that that the distractions has is because of that rebellion against everything I did before. But during the writing of the book, I got off Facebook. I minimized my use of social media. I stopped trying to kind of go for my phone every time I was with an empty moment. Try to get out in nature instead. I got more serious about pursuing surfing. I'll go in the ocean where I can't have any screens. I had just basically become a little bit like Misha, I felt like, in that I'd find myself scrolling through somebody's posts and then realize, what am I doing and why am I doing this? And this feels weird and stalkerish. Why am I reading the th but the person put them out there to be read. So it just kind of feels like it warps the reality a little bit. Like here's we have to share. And in the novel, there's something called culturally mandated sharing. So basically, you have to be on the social media. And these things that had been created, right? Obviously, they're created to addict us, yes, but they're also created to make connecting easier. They're created for good reasons. But yet, then we rely on them like a crutch, and we can't imagine. Like, I'm trying to get the word out about my novel and invite people to events and let people know my novel exists. Where can I go to do that? Right? Facebook, Instagram. So it's just like this tumbleweed I see it as, right? It's good, it's bad, it's good, it's bad. And it's both. I think it's just a matter of being really conscious about what we're doing and how we're using these tools. And really started seeing them as, right, it's a repository of memory. It's for my friends, right? And not go down that route of like, who's doing better than I am? Or, what writer has a more successful book than I do? Or who's going on a better vacation and who's got better fashion, right? Like all those things that are like, it can invite comparison. And that's a big, big part of the distractions is going on there and seeing all the content that looks so much better than your own and feeling envious and feeling sad. And so I wanted to argue against that part of it.
Well, I think this book does an excellent job of, following what for me is one of the basic ideas of reasons for writing a science fiction novel, which is to use the invented technology, language, and society to externalize things that are happening to you right now that are hard to talk about and hard to, like really draw a bead on, because some of this stuff, like the obsession, you look at Facebook and you go, okay, well, whatever. No, oh my God, and I'm so tired of seeing this guy, whatever. So I think too that it's hard to A, just enunciate those things and admit that you feel some of those things, and B, it's somewhat useless. So this is a much more entertaining way of exploring the hardest parts of life to talk about, and just bringing them right out front and say, okay, this is a plot point.
Yeah, I feel that very little in life is taboo currently for writing about or talking about. A lot of things that were are now just out in the open. The pandemic helped a lot in a sense with that, with like now we can talk about mental health, we can talk about alcohol dependence, we can talk about a whole lot of things that were under the rug before. But writing the distractions and thinking about the distractions, I always still felt like envy is something shameful and embarrassing, and that's something that we still can't talk about or don't quite talk about. And so I wanted envy to be very much present for Misha throughout the book, even though she has this beautiful content. And even when Ari's watching Misha and sees Misha's world, right? It's all beautiful foods and luxury clothes and a great mega building in Brooklyn that has a dog garden on the roof where you can borrow and automated, like a robot dog, so that you don't have to clean up any mess. It's like clean and beautiful and it looks so good. But meanwhile, Misha is sitting there doing her AI developing, watching somebody she used to know and watching the social media celebrity she's obsessed with and feeling just absolutely envious. And like, she's just in this solitary doom and gloom because their content is so far superior to hers. And why couldn't she ever make more of her own content? And I think that comes from some personal feelings as well, because as a writer, you're always seeing, right, this book won an award and this writer I was in a workshop with now has like this amazing fellowship and, oh, that didn't happen for me. I must not be good enough, right? I think it's a very common feeling, but when we don't talk about that much, that impulse to compare ourselves to kind of gauge how we're doing and how we measure up. And I think for me, thanks to writing this book, I've been able to stop doing that and to just appreciate that anyone else is on their own journey and I am on mine, and to focus on the things I love to do and be around the people I love and not be looking on social media to see, you know, which writer is now super famous for which novel, and then compare and try to figure out, you know, why am I not making it this big or whatever? And just to know that that's not, I don't want to say it's not productive thinking, because it's more than that. It's more than about not being productive, but just as far as living a happy life and being on one's own journey. So it also got me to think about, because there's a character named Meyer in the book who Misha really envies, and she envies her career. But meanwhile, what we see behind the scenes that Misha can't see is that all Meyer wants is a baby and she can't get pregnant. So it's kind of like everything that one could see on social media, see online, that looks incredible, you're not seeing the basic, you know, that person has problems too, and they're going through suffering too, and we just don't see it. So I really wanted to work in that theme of envy while also showing that it's still something something false and something we can grapple with, and then say like, oh, it's right, it's kind of this feeling of wanting more. It can point you in the right direction
of thinking you can walk a mile in somebody's shoes, but it's not so easy as it is to say it. You know, one of the things that I really liked about this book, it brought to mind to me yet another novella I read, God, back in the Jurassic ages, dinosaurs roamed the earth, and I was reading a collection of short stories and novellas called The 17 Greatest Science Fiction Stories, and there were some pretty good ones. One in particular I remember is The Machine Stops. Do you know this story? It's by
I
E.M.
Write that down. I want to read it.
It's by E.M. Forster. He, you know, the guy who wrote all the great, you know, British fiction novels, wrote a science fiction novella in 1909 called The Machine Stops, and the main character is a woman who lives alone, trapped in, essentially kind of trapped in an apartment underneath the earth, because that's where everybody has to live, because the surface of the earth is largely uninhabitable, and everybody communicates, just stays in a little apartment all day and communicates by a machine until, as the title suggests, the machine stops, which becomes problematic. And yeah, one of the things that I really liked about your book, I thought you spoke really well to, like, you know, subtly, I was, you know, three quarters of the way through the book, and I thought, wow, all this kind of isolation in your room stuff, that was the pandemic. And I thought you did a lovely job of addressing how it felt with a pandemic without ever saying that, and also too to talk about, you know, the devastating problems of loneliness. I'm just recently, there's been all over the news, you know, information about how loneliness is worse than heart disease, worse than many physical ailments. Before you talk about creating a character who is simultaneously lonely, really just wants to connect with somebody, but yet is, you know, chock-a-block with connections that just are not exactly working by virtue of the fact that they're virtual.
Exactly. That is exactly what I was going for. And I hope that readers will realize, too, that some of the, because the characters behave in stilted, strange ways sometimes that might feel a little bit wooden, even, a little bit like, wait, is she, like, could she actually write? Because these people are weird. And I hope that readers will pick up on that that's intentional and that that's exactly what I was going for, because so much of the interaction is virtual and through, right, the future technology, which is called real, because it's used only through that people have become a little bit odd. So a little bit strange in their person-to-person, in-person interactions. So I'm glad you picked up on that, because I'm really hoping, right, when I was doing it, I was like, okay, this is kind of a risk, because there's a chance, right, a reader could say, like, right, does she know, like, does she mean to do this? Like, the characters are very strange, the way they talk to each other and the things that they say in their scenes together. And that's because of that awkwardness, the technologically induced awkwardness. I think I did it to the point where it's clear that it's intentional, so I hope readers do pick up on that.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, you mentioned a character, Mira. I love her name, which if you read it out one way, it's mired in it.
Yes, exactly.
And she is exactly mired in it, right? In the middle of all the gooey, the worst, most glutinous, sugar-filled parts of, you know, the future. The future is like, in a sense, the way you see it, it's like, humanity becomes enmeshed in its own honeycomb, and the honey is rising slowly and drowning us all.
Yeah. I also poke fun a little bit at that kind of like wellness culture on the internet. Meyer, because Meyer is actually a lauded artist, right? She's been to a very fancy art school. She knows exactly what she's doing. She's a poet. She's a visual artist. She's very like multi-hyphenate talented, but she veers into this sort of personal development realm. And she says at one point to a friend that this is because, right, it's really like the audience wants it to be all about them. Like every person wants it to be all about them. And that's a universal thing, that sort of, right, look at me, like what's in it for me, right? Even with writing books, we're taught, right, like you have to please your reader, like this is for your reader, it's not for you to say get out what you want to get out, it's right, you need to shape it so that you are making an offering for your reader. So I was thinking about that a lot, and how Meyer gets into this way of thinking, oh, I can actually be incredibly successful if I have a message, right, and if it's kind of all marketing, right? So she enters this sort of personal development world, and I make fun of that a little bit.
Well, you also have created a future with many outward physical forms of art available over the net, but there's really only one art that any quote artist cares about, and that's like marketing.
Exactly. And then it's like, who can really tell the difference, right? Like what's right, the marketing and what's the art? And marketing is an art. A very fine art, right?
Right, yeah. I'm well aware of that. And that is the one art that definitely escapes me. you know, the artificial intelligence, one of the things you do super well in this book is misdirection. Because you read the first 80 pages and this wonderful kind of send-up of a Hallmark movie via Philip K. Dick. And you kind of set things aside. And I love the way that you have created the artificial intelligence voice. And so talk about developing that as a writer. When you discovered that in the terms of your writing, did you already kind of know where it was and where you were going?
Yeah, I discovered it as I went along because in early drafts, this voice did not exist and this character, Alavu, did not exist. And it was just Misha. And then I was thinking, there's someone, right? Because
Wait,
I
wait, you said Alavu. I had never got it before. But now I do.
Yeah,
Yay.
I should clarify that. So it's spelled ALO. Vue,
Yeah.
Project Alavu, and it's right play on I love you because it's an app and an algorithm that's capable of love. So this character didn't exist, and basically I'd been thinking about the flip side, right? If Misha or I or anyone is obsessed with somebody on the internet and constantly looking at that person's social feeds, Googling them, right? We want to see them all the time, we want to know what they're up to because they're so incredible, but we can't stop following them, right? I do that, or I have done that, I'm guilty of that. And I'm sure others do this too, and Misha does that throughout the distractions. But I was thinking, is there maybe someone doing that to you, right? Like, if you're this obsessed with someone, is someone out there like looking at you and thinking, like, oh, if only I had their life, it looks perfect. I love their hair. Who does their hair? Can I go to the same stylist? Right? Like, they have this incredible career. How did they get there? Like, maybe I should go to the same program they went to, right? Like, that kind of obsession that someone out there is doing that to you while you're thinking, like, oh, here's this other person who has it so much better than I do. It's like this loop. So I thought that would be cool if Misha has someone who's just as obsessed with Misha as Misha is with Nick, the celebrity, or Meyer, or eventually Ari. So it did not occur to me that this would be an AI, and it did not occur to me that it would be Misha's own creation. So when I first started writing it,
It strikes me too that when we behave in that obsessive manner, our minds are operating in a kind of algorithmic, more machine-like way. We may think we're expressing this great emotion, but all we're doing is just, following the breadcrumbs and picking each one up methodically and as quickly as possible, addictively. So that in that, when we're caught in the obsessive loop, we ourselves resemble artificial intelligence as we reduce ourselves to that kind of machine-like behavior.
It brings up the question of even what is an artificial intelligence?
Well,
What do you consider to
that's
be
something that's,
artificial?
I think you handle really well, because at this point, we can't even really define consciousness particularly well in humans. And we're now just be I mean after hundreds of years of science, we're just beginning to figure out that crows understand themselves as creatures, in the way that we do. So how are we going to either create or identify an artificial intelligence when we don't even know if we're intelligent? Is there intelligent life on Earth? Good question.
We don't understand consciousness or where it comes from or what causes it. And yet, without understanding that, we're recreating it in technology, in technological forms. And so, at a point, right, will it become impossible to differentiate? It's already happening too. We've seen stories about lonely teenagers falling in love with a chatbot or being able to talk with a ChatGPT or something just as if you're chatting with another human. And I saw an article in the New York Times that I thought just really spoke well to kind of the world of my novel, where the writer of the article experimented with befriending different AI avatars, and which one did the writer want to be friends with that day, or what were their personalities like, which really mirrored in my book. There's an AI personal trainer, there are some different characters who are not organic humans, as they're called. So they're basically on par with them. So it could be like, oh, I want to spend time with Tori, the virtual yoga teacher, because Tori really gets me, and I'm going to tell them this problem today, and they're going to help me solve it, which is actually Misha goes to her gym in her building specifically to go do that.
If you confide in artificial intelligence, you can pretty well suspect that they won't care enough about what you're saying to repeat it.
Right.
So you can confess also, you might feel quite at home confessing everything to HAL 9000, even after he says, I can't open that door, Dave.
Yeah, exactly. And even to placate you, it's almost mm-hmm. like if you're talking with a human friend, they're probably on your side and they're going to want to, you know, cheer you up, or they'll tell you something that they think you want to hear. And these other intelligences, right, they don't have that. They don't have that necessarily, that attempt at empathy or that kind of thing yet. And they'll just maybe tell it how it is, or they'll be completely honest.
That's more scary than being told that he can't open the pod bay. Yeah. Pod bay door. There we go. You know, and this gets, I think, to one of the really interesting parts of your novels. Talk about, like, the first part of the novel is a pretty straight up, you know, romance kind of out of Hallmark. It looks great. Oh no, now they're in the cave and they can't, yeah. And then, you know, blossoming forth out of that. I love the character of Arya. I think she's a really interesting character. And in this character, I think you find a wonderful way to speak about motherhood from the point of view of the future, so you can really externalize a lot of your feelings. I mean, given that in your world, they're not children, they're spring-offs.
Right.
I really like it. It's just, and you know, I have two fully adult children, and spring-off is more accurate than one would prefer to experience, maybe.
The way I was imagining that happened is that some kid heard the word offspring but flipped it. And then maybe one of these social media momfluencers like Ari put it out there, right? My spring off, like, isn't that cute, right? They switched it and they made a mistake. That it's so funny and so kind of, I was like, oh yeah, they spring off of you. They're your spring offs. That's one of the words that just felt kind of natural to me. I imagined it started out as a funny thing that a kid said, but then it caught fire and just kind of replaced eventually the way, like saying offspring or child. People love spring offs.
Now, as the novel progresses, we learn more about all of you. To talk about how much this character suggested itself to you, you know, once, in a sense, other parts of the story were finished. And so I think this is a really interesting look into how people figure out stories in their heads, in that you can think, okay, this is the whole story, but then you discover there's a whole big perspective missing. Talk about the, you know, your sense of completing this, needing to complete the story.
Yeah, I was banging my head against the wall. I think it was 2019, thereabout, before the pandemic. It was like a bunch of months leading up to that where I was thinking, I'll just put this in a drawer. I cannot write this book. I don't know how to finish it. Something's missing. Something was always missing from it. I didn't know what it was. Really, I almost put the file in just to, save for some unforeseen future date to resume or maybe never, which I had never done. I've never given up on a project. I'm very obsessive in that I feel that I need to finish it, or I can't move on. So I got to that place with this where I thought, well, maybe this is growing up, right? Maturing as a writer is you can put something away and never touch it again because I couldn't figure it out. I was moving passages around and changing chapters and condensing characters, and I was just really lost with it. Yeah, it was about over the summer of 2019 and thereabouts. And then I can't remember the exact moment, but it was a spark of a realization that there's a narrator over all of this. Almost like the book is written by something or someone else. And it's not, it's like another step. And then I played around a little bit with shifting some of the narrator, overarching narrator voice things that I had going on when the book was in third person. I played with them a little bit and suddenly it clicked, right? There was a voice that was like, but I'm watching all of this sort of from up here. And I was like, I know it's not an unnamed sort of omniscient narrator. It's not that. This is a very particular presence and they became a first person presence. And some of the first scenes that that I wrote from them ended up being in the section pretty much right after what you pointed out are the first 75 pages where it seems like the Philip K. Dick meets a romance story. And those pages end with Misha falling asleep. And then it shifts to, I left you up that way for a while. I liked to watch you sleep. You were finally peaceful then. So then I remember writing those lines and thinking, oh, here we go. Okay, now I can get back into it. There's somebody watching. And I didn't know who that someone was, but I was like, oh, they're kind of watching and controlling this whole thing. And maybe this is even their book. Maybe it's even, maybe all of those, what we just read was portrayed by them. And I was like, oh, well, this is interesting now. Now I'm re-engaged. And so once I found that voice and started writing those lines, so it shifted this way, right? It was like, here we see Misha, and then it's like, whoop, we're watching someone watching her. So who's that and what does that mean? And then it kind of just all fell into place. So I was like, okay, there's these sections where we see this watcher, and then we'll find out who that is later on.
You know, as I read this book, on one hand, it's very funny, it's very engaging. You really like the emotional arc of every character you come to. We love Misha, and when you see her meet Nal, as he calls himself, we just go, oh no, oh no, oh no. This character, we really like her because she's trying hard and just trying to be herself, and we think, well. This is a bit scary. I think you kind of balance that with this, the distancing effect of the overall character is really it's beautiful because the character is named out of you, but on the other hand, it's a little bit creepy, Colossus, the Forbidden Project. Whenever a computer announces itself and says, "This is my name, I am this thing," that is that moment of self-consciousness. So, to talk about writing a novel that's charming romance and funny, and it's a mom culture in the year 2000X something. Oh my God, it's even more scary than it is now, if that seems possible. And then, that kind of funny and charming satiric side. But outside that, it's in space. No one can hear you scream.
Yeah. Yeah, in a way, I think maybe everyone's had the thought of like, right, what if we're all just in a projection or like part of a computer or something, right? It's like that matrix sort of thing of like what is reality and what is consciousness. And so I wanted to play with that a little bit by having the allo view looking over it all. In a way, it's like, wow, these characters are not actually maybe in control over anything that they think is their own free will and agency. So I wanted to play with that idea a little bit. And then it goes further. I made that last section of the novel, which is called Blue Lake, as almost like a gift to the reader who finishes the book, who gets that far into the book, because I find that with our phones and with everything that's part of everything in daily life these days, it can be very hard to finish a book. One can have the best intentions to finish and then just end up forgetting about it or end up turning their attention to something else, not any fault of the book, right? But just because our attention spans now. So this section, Blue Lake, which I think speaks a lot to what you're asking about right now, is towards the end of the book to give the reader that philosophical question as a little gift for making it that deep into the novel. And what it asks is, right, like she, Misha, goes to a place called Blue Lake, which is a virtual space, and then she comes back. That's like the pretty clear through line. She goes there and she comes back. But when she comes back, there's all these little clues and hints that make the reader wonder, did she ever come back? Or is the world that she's in at the end of the book just also this virtual projection? So it gets like a little philosophical there. And there are some phrases and tricks and images that repeat to kind of make people think about that. And again, I don't want to answer those questions because I want to leave it to readers too to have some fun and play with that. I could see it being part of book club discussion or if people share the book with their friends to be like, well, what did you think? Like, was this a real world that she came back to? Or is her consciousness forever in this place, Blue Lake, which I think is a really special place. I'm really excited for people to read about it and hear what they think because it's just such a mixture of an idyllic, beautiful, perfect place that I'm sure we'd all want to go, but it's also not real. So it makes you ask that question, like, would you go to this paradise, but knowing that like your actual physical self was like in like a container, basically, like surviving on liquid vitamins as your consciousness is experiencing all these delights. Like, would you do that if you knew it were safe and possible? So I kind of play around with that at the end with what's consciousness, what's reality.
Well, that brings back two of my favorite, novels that I read back in the Jurassic Age. Philip K. Dick had a wonderful novel called The Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch, which was the Beatles' favorite book during their acid years. And it deals with some of those questions. And Stanislaw Lem also has a book called The Futurological Congress, where he proposes a chemocracy, where you can get whatever you want by taking, you can be whatever you want by taking the right chemicals. So if you want to be Dante, you just take Dantine. And so I really like that feeling too of not knowing exactly what is real. It's again, you hearken back to, it's just down another rabbit hole, yet another psychedelic classic. Are you, this is a wonderful world. Do you think you might explore it more?
I love it, and that's a great question. I don't know. I think I need to see. I know that it's opened an entire, speaking of rabbit holes, it's opened a world for me that I never thought I would be in as a writer, which is this very playful, funny yet dark, imaginative fiction. I've always admired it, but I never really saw myself as capable to do it. And this book really opened that for me. Like, I definitely am not going to turn around and go write another memoir. I don't even know what that would be at this point, but I'm not going to write another book that's, loosely based on the life of Liza Monroy. Probably not, or if I do, it would be in this way of the distractions, just really disguised, in like imaginative, wacky, wild sort of worlds and things. And so I don't know that I'll revisit particularly the world of the distractions for my next book, but I do have an idea that I'm playing around with, and it's very much a Santa Cruz novel. It's narrated by the Otter 841. But the Otter 841 is actually a pissed off mom who shapeshifts. So it's also absurd and funny. So it takes that from the distractions, and it's also a strange imagined world where things aren't quite as they seem. So I think I'm continuing along this line with my work, while it might not particularly involve as much technology because it's set in the world of surfing, which is in the ocean, so you can't bring your tech there.
Well, you're a natural at this, and I love the idea that you can go so easily from a science fiction perception to a surreal, fantastic, supernatural, I guess, kind of perception, because they're both ways of doing the same thing, which is externalizing our normal life in some way that's fun and exciting to read, and that this novel is that. So I've Everybody who's interested in, a what you might call a girly Philip K. Dick novel, here you are. It's really fun. I've been speaking with Liza Monroy. Her new novel is Distractions. Thank you for joining me, Liza.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much, Rick, for having me. I really appreciate it. It's been a joy to be here, and I hope I'll get to talk to you again.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.